Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 92, where Greta, Tom, Pedro, and our special guest Rohin are presenting the case of the Manhattan Project and its illustrations of total institution and organizational secrecy. In part two, we will discuss the contemporary implications of the case, attempting to answer questions such as, should there be another Manhattan Project for fill in the blank? If you missed part one, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So, Rohin, I really sympathize with, you know, your interest in understanding innovation and knowledge sharing from a sociological perspective. You know, my entire dissertation was about boundary work, so I got very excited when we started talking about that. And listening to the Richard Feynman lecture, there were a couple of examples that I would love to connect with a conversation we had in part one, where you kind of mentioned that, you know, the whole way Los Alamos site was being coordinated and managed, it was almost like a totalitarian institution, and there were clear boundaries and color badges and, you know, doors with locks, and how do you call these? These archival drawers with locks on them to keep the information inside. But then, in a way, I think if you look at it from, you know, the role of boundary work, and that's kind of, you know, the efforts people put into creating boundaries, maintaining them, breaking them down, sometimes making them permeable. So all the work, the effort, the human effort people put into upholding a boundary or temporarily opening it. And when you look at, you know, the physicists and the scientists working at the plant, they knew exactly how to do that, right? Like there's this one example from the Feynman lecture where they're complaining about these drawers having locks. And then Feynman says, yes, but there was a way that you could open it from the back. And then there is this other physicist that says, yeah, that's the reason why I don't keep my records in the drawer. I just keep it in my desk. And then during the meeting where he said that, and they discussed the security of, you know, keeping information locked away outside of, I guess, working hours. And then during that meeting, Richard Feynman leaves and he goes to that desk. And from the back of the desk, he can just pull out all the pages of information out of the desk drawer, even though it was locked. You know, these are really funny, you know, moments that he shares. You know, we can all laugh about it. But if we abstract from the case, it shows, even though a boundary, like, you know, that's, for instance, put in place in an innovation to protect IP, if you make a parallel, that it's selectively permeable. Like the people that need to cross it every now and then know exactly how to do that, even when they don't have the exact permissions. And perhaps, you know, that is also, that plays a role in speeding up innovation. I see parallels, for instance, with one of my studies where, you know, IP boundaries, they were building, like they were developing the plans to build a factory in China, and the Chinese engineers were not allowed to go into, you know, the part of the office where, you know, people are working on the intellectual property part. But in a way, they had to share knowledge and work, collaborate. So they had all these solutions to make it, you know, semi-permeable sometimes, but keeping it closed at other times. And I would love to hear more, like what your thoughts are on these small micro practices that a lot of people talk about in the documentary and perhaps elsewhere, and the role that that had in realizing this innovation in a phenomenally short amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there, but let me start with another fun example from the Feynman lecture, which is he talks about how there was at Los Alamos, again, I mentioned how there's a fence within a fence, but there's that outer fence. He talks about how there was a hole in the fence because some of the workers lived outside that campus and it was too far for them to walk all the way to the main gate and come in. So they just cut a hole in the fence. And so that's the most on the nose example of boundary work you're ever going to see. But yes, I think naturally, and this is where my, like you mentioned, Greta, my dissertation interest on the bringing the sociology of secrecy into knowledge work comes at it exactly in this way, which is two things. A, that there is a bunch of gray area, there's a bunch of perforation or permeation between boundaries, and B, that these gray areas have both epistemic and social implications. For example, Feynman, on just the knowledge front, Feynman talks about how they were trying to solve a problem at Oak Ridge through military mail sensors about assaying how much uranium is in the uranium nitrate solution that kind of comes out of the process. It wasn't working, so then they got permission to go there. They got permission to solve that. Let's call that problem A. When Emilio Segre then went there, he serendipitously noticed a different problem, problem B, related to safe handling practices, because they didn't realize that when it's in the solution form, it takes a lesser amount of uranium to explode. That's an example where that selective permeation to solve one problem led to solutions of other problems as well, because you had the right knowledge in the right place in a tactile manner where he could just see something that other people don't even recognize as a problem. And then Feynman gives us a different example, which comes to the social side of this boundary work, which is where at Los Alamos, he talks about the special engineer detachment, and they were working on IBM calculation machines and they were struggling. So the numbers he gives roughly are they were able to solve 3 problems in 9 months. And then he got permission from the military to, because these engineers didn't know anything about what the problems, they were punching cards and doing computations. The moment Feynman then gave them a kind of mini lecture on the basics of atomic physics and what this is about, they, at least he reports that they were super motivated, working night shifts, writing their own programs to solve problems themselves. It went from, let's say, 3 problems in 9 months to he says 9 problems in 3 months. And so there's also that, not just boundary work in terms of knowledge flowing to the right place, but boundary work in terms of you're kind of including people a bit more instead of keeping them just arm's length. The kind of analogy I like to think of, if I can take a second, is, so Michael Polanyi, philosopher, chemist, just kind of modern day polymath, wrote about how scientific work is like solving a large jigsaw puzzle globally. And then when people see one part of the puzzle coming into place, it helps the kind of attach their own pieces, and collaboratively everyone solves this puzzle. And so there, the visibility is very important. What secrecy does technically is that you're just given some jigsaw pieces, and you're just told, solve this bit. And you're not even told whether it's part of a larger puzzle or anything. A, this is hard because you would have to have that much administrative prescience to know exactly what the puzzle looks like beforehand so that you're able to cut it up and give people specific subsets. But then B, it also has this element where now I'm bringing in your points about boundary work and the permeation and these middle grounds between secrecy and openness. Assume instead of just blackening out the rest of the puzzle, it's gray. Or like I tell you that there is a larger puzzle that you're working on, or I selectively show you some pieces. All of this increases both the social motivation, but also the serendipity element. Now you might find a piece of the puzzle that doesn't fit with your domain, but now that you know that there's something bigger going on, you're more likely to pass it along that, hey, this might be useful for someone else in some other site. And so I think of secrecy as like working on this puzzle, but blacked out. And then I think of all this gray area as literally gray areas on that jigsaw puzzle where you're able to see some bits, or you at least know that there's a larger puzzle being solved.
I also think there's another element of secrecy worth bringing in, because there's sort of like the normative control aspects, the environment of secrecy. Because on the one hand, you know, some of the things are being kept secret. You could make a logical or a rational connection from the piece of information to the harm that could be caused when it was disclosed. But when it came to, for example, the business about mail censorship, the business, you know, some of these other things where you wonder exactly what is being protected apart from the organization providing barriers for the purposes of reminding folks that they're in a secure environment. The mail censorship would seem to be like an example of that, because this is part of the Feynman lecture where he's talking about, you know, I'm trying to do something with my wife and the censors are cutting information out, not necessarily because there's anything that could be necessarily connected to, you know, a piece of information that could be harmful so much as almost as just a reminder that we're watching you because we have to watch you, or I'm not sure I'm putting it the right way, but you get the idea. And so there's, I don't know if that's really secrecy or is that normative control?
So this is interesting. And I wanted to use that to think of the aftermath of the Manhattan Project, right? In the world we live in which government secrets are still very prevalent, right? And I was recently reading a very interesting review by Stephen Chapin in the London Review of Books. And he's reviewing the book by Alex Wellerstein, Restricted Data, which is exactly about the history of nuclear secrets in the US, right? And it's exactly trying to look at what happened ever since and the different ways people have thought of how to keep some information secret and how, for some people, especially the scientists, the idea was not just to restrict documents, but try to have a regulation and control of the production of some materials that are used for nuclear power and so on, right? And all how there's different battles going around since the Manhattan Project on what you should keep secret, what you should regulate, and so on. But what happens today is that this blackening out that Rahim was describing has, in a way, become more prevalent, right? So in this very piece that I'm quoting, at some point, the author says that the US government classifies more pages of documents than the ones that are added to the Library of Congress. So, for example, in 2015, 53,000 new classifications actions were taking place, and 52 million derivative classifications for new documents containing previously classified materials also took place. So there's a lot of blackening out taking place, right? There is an enormous machinery in the state bureaucracy that seems to be doing that. And it seems that some of the pragmatic considerations that we are all talking about in terms of the boundary work that was taking place at work, this understanding, what to keep secret or not, you know, this tension between trying to keep the normative control, but at the same time facilitate the work, you know, in some ways has evolved. And in some ways, this attention to that has expanded, right? Even if sometimes based on some kind of paradigm of the document as a written product, right? They can just like, you know, put a black ink on top of words.
No, I appreciate that. Because one of the things that I think contributes to this is to this expansion or this proliferation of classification is the different way, the different kinds of harms that come about. Originally, we're talking about the knowledge that a particular fact could be harmful if disclosed with relation to the construction of the bomb. Disclosure of personal information, I believe, came later, like, you know, HIPAA, what we call HIPAA in the United States. I don't know what it is, but it's basically protection of health information, protection of education records. I mean, there's a lot of things that have grown and proliferated across governments as far as what information needs to be protected for different reasons. And then you have, in the United States, we call it the Freedom of Information Act, which is a way of trying to ensure that the creation of these boundaries, you still have the ability to access information that is in the public good so that the government doesn't keep too much secret. It's a very, very complicated web, isn't it not?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is. And I think what a lot of these laws and kind of data governance or information governance scholars as well are looking at is what determines legitimate versus illegitimate protection or legitimate versus illegitimate secrecy. And often, like Pedro was saying, once you have that cultural and bureaucratic apparatus in place, you're more likely to take protection as your first port of call, regardless of whether it's actually strategic and legitimate to protect what you're protecting, or you're doing it just because that's what you're set up to do. But what is also interesting about secrecy, and this kind of harkens back to work by Georg Simmel, is that it changes the value of the content of the knowledge being concealed as well, where you are more likely to value it because it is restricted. And so then there's almost a sort of circle or some kind of endogeneity there, where is this valuable enough to protect it, or is this valuable because it is protected? And I think a lot of the government decisions on what to keep and share, and a lot of these FOIA and other such acts are looking at where that line gets drawn. But I just want to add to all of those points, saying that there's on top of all of that, there's also like a performative element to some of this secrecy, where it's less about protecting the knowledge, more about being seen to protect the knowledge. And so it's hard, it's it's super interesting, but also hard to unpack all of those, of course.
There are two other things that I would love to talk about related to, you know, the organizational aspect of the Manhattan Project. One is the role of Robert Oppenheimer. Like in one of the documentaries that we watched, he was really portrayed as being this boundary spanner. Like I think the Los Alamos plant had like 7 different divisions with all different disciplines. And he was like one of the, he was, you know, portrayed as one of the few persons that could connect the knowledge and really understand what people were working on in each of these 7 divisions. So his incredible intellect and understanding of different subject areas. And the second one is the image that you shared with us and the role of women. We know that at Bletchley Park, as well as at NASA, women have played an incredible role in massive innovations. I don't know, Rowan, if you have any insight there, like what were their roles? Like you mentioned, not everybody in these sites was working on development of the atomic bomb, but can you tell a bit about the division of labor across genders?
So regarding Oppenheimer, I think it's important to cover him. I'm a little bit quietly pleased that we haven't covered him until so late into the episode, because often there is a bit too much of that cult of personality where and I don't know if I'm going to get hate mail for this, but I think the Manhattan Project would have succeeded without Oppenheimer as well. But maybe it would have been way taken longer or a lot more infighting. So he was a very, very able administrator by all accounts, including people like Edward Teller, who had a lot of friction with him. They always still concede that, okay, he was a really good link person. And I think it comes down to, one is him being able to be that kind of perspective taking and understanding people's viewpoints and politics type of leader, where he's arbitrating between the military and between the scientists. He was fighting, for example, in the early days of Los Alamos to set up weekly colloquia for the scientists to share their knowledge, which the military were first pushing back against. Then they allowed it for just the white badged, i.e. the top security clearance scientists. So he was a great arbitrator in that sense. And he was very respected by the scientists also because of his intellect. And some people have talked about this in terms of status. You know, he wasn't a Nobel Prize winner or anyone. And, you know, he didn't win a Nobel later either. And he was working with a lot of Nobel winners on site. But they all respected that he understands the problem quickly. He might not be the next, you know, Nobel laureate, but he understands all. He has a good grasp and a quick mind to pick up what's needed. And I think there's almost that element there where it's I guess it talks of a broader trade-off between generalist and specialist leaders. And he specialized in being a generalist almost. You know, he could talk to you about anything from French literature to Sanskrit poetry to physics to chemistry to abstract math. And people recognized that in him and appreciated him for that intellect. But by all accounts, he stepped into that role. It's not like he was already someone showing all of those capabilities, but once given that mandate and that platform, he really grew into it and became the super kind of administrator. Everyone would come to him with their problems. He would keep everyone kind of happy, which was not easy by any means at Los Alamos. I mean, if this wasn't clear from earlier in the episode, he was the scientific director of Los Alamos. So it's not like he was also overseeing Hanford and Oak Ridge. He was very much focused on the Los Alamos site. So that's a bit on Oppenheimer. And, you know, others can pick up on that as well. But just to address your second point about the division of labor, a quick caveat, there was, of course, a lot of social inequality that I'm glossing over, not because of lack of interest, but because of lack of knowledge, where I haven't read up on it as much. But, you know, even in the barracks, for example, African-Americans were, you know, segregated and not allowed to bring any family members, etc. And so the role of women in some areas was similar to what we see in popular depictions, like I think the movie was called Hidden Figures, talking about NASA, etc. So there was that role where women are doing a lot of the calculations, because a lot of the calculations are manual. But the bigger role, and that's kind of in the image you were alluding to of workers just leaving the Oak Ridge facility, the bigger role was in the more operational tasks. So, for example, if you're working at one of the plants in Oak Ridge, your job might be to just sit in front of a calutron machine, watch the dial. If it crosses a certain thing, you let person X know. And so for that, they kind of went on a hiring spree across the regions that they picked. So near Los Alamos, near Oak Ridge, etc. And they would, I mean, some anecdotes involve them, the administrators just walking into a diner and talking to the waitress there and saying, how would you like to work for X amount? It was much more money. And that's how they kind of recruited for a lot of those positions, which is also then interesting from a secrecy perspective and in terms of how that would work today, because it's one thing when your innovation is such that you have thousands of jobs that involve just looking at a dial and letting someone know if it crosses a particular point or working in the cafeteria or whatever, versus when it's all knowledge workers involved in the organization.
I'd like to follow on with Oppenheimer because his story, and this will sort of tie into talking the geopolitics of all of this, is how his role changed after World War II had ended. The concerns or the questions raised over his past and his political orientations prior to World War II or prior to the Manhattan Project kind of haunted him in a way, because after the project was over, he took a very strong position that these weapons are terrible and that, no nation should ever use them again. And this put him kind of squarely against what was unfortunately the tide that led, towards nuclear proliferation and the advent of the Cold War, where nations started to pursue the weapons instead and look to protect themselves against potential enemies as the world was starting to divide. And he kind of fell on the out and reached a point where he not only wasn't interested in continuing his scientific work, he wasn't really allowed to either.
Yeah. I think, and there's kind of two forces that were working together to that outcome in Oppenheimer's case. One was the fact that there was always suspicion from the military over his friendship with people who were kind of communist affiliated and organizers, etc. And this is back from Oppenheimer's Berkeley days. He had a dual professorship at Berkeley and Caltech. And so even from the beginning of the Manhattan Project, there was always some surveillance and as to his, not him personally, but his ties and the friends that he kept, which then blew up afterwards, especially because afterwards the objective changed from let's build a bomb before the Axis powers to let's keep the Soviets from getting bomb technology. But also simultaneously after the war, Oppenheimer's view very much changed towards open information sharing for the sake of global governance around nuclear weapons. And just as the country is entering into a Cold War era of espionage and being, kind of paranoid, it doesn't help that this person who they were already investigating for communist links is espousing open communication and global governance and sharing. And of course, it wasn't just Oppenheimer. A lot of the scientists, they formed, I think it's called the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. They formed kind of a journal to argue for kind of peaceful ways forward. I think in the documentary they mention, they have a little quote from Oppenheimer in an interview where they talk about global governance, etc. And I think this must have been around in the 60s, the interview, because Oppenheimer just in an almost defeated voice says, this discussion is 20 years too late. There was definitely a kind of a loss of spirit for him, and there's almost a tragic hero element to his story.
Yeah, in fact, that's why the documentary was named The Day After Trinity. That was what he had cited, was the day after Trinity is when we should have put the kibosh on the whole thing. Then we wouldn't have been in this situation. The day after Trinity refers to the day of the test, the first test of a weapon near Los Alamos.
I wanted to add, because this might be interesting also from our earlier discussion about purpose and taking a step back to look at the implications. Even before kind of Oppenheimer, and let's say before the day after Trinity, there were a group of physicists, or let's just scientists at the University of Chicago who were very involved with the Manhattan Project. UChicago was one of the sites of the project before Los Alamos was set up. And those physicists actually organized and wrote to the government, and they had a plan in place to prevent the use of the atomic bombs. And it's a thought that just occurred to me now, but maybe there's something there about the fact that that organization came from a bit of a distance from Los Alamos. It took the scientists who were one step removed from the day-to-day work of the project to kind of ruminate on the implications and start trying to organize things and plan documents and petition the government, etc. And it perhaps ties back to that story that they were not part of that relentless purpose felt in Los Alamos towards building the bomb.
That's really interesting what you say here, because my thinking was exactly in the opposite direction. 2 years after the dropping of the bomb, there was this MIT talk that Oppenheimer gave, and a quote from it, he said, "The physicists have known sin, and this is a knowledge they cannot lose." You know, when he gave that talk, there actually came a wide reaction towards his lecture of other physicists that completely disagreed with him, saying that they had been working on an honest piece of scientific work to win the war. So Oppenheimer being like kind of this central actor in one of the plans, knowing exactly how all the disciplines worked, what was going on, being able to integrate the knowledge, and then seeing how once the bomb was functional, it got deployed in a way that he saw what the impact was. Yeah, perhaps the people that have been advocating for regulation around the use of atomic weapons came from the periphery, but the people that knew what the innovation the bomb was capable to achieve was very much at the core, and the inability to have a say in how it was deployed. And this makes me think about like current developments, like, for instance, if you think about massive innovations, think about like the use of drones in war to develop drones that can identify targets. You have to use human labor to identify what's on pictures in order for the automation to recognize certain targets. A lot of this work or similar work is being done on Amazon Mechanical Turk. You can also think about like, and the people that do that work don't know, they just complete a fraction of a piece of work towards a bigger thing, but they never know what the bigger thing is. Like another thing is, you know, often when you're, you know, when I use Google Scholar to search for articles to find the references for my references list, every 5 citations I get like this CAPTCHA, like to prove I'm not a robot. That's what it says. But then I have to click on images that has a yellow taxi or a traffic light. And then I'm like, okay, well, besides it being annoying, like, why do I have to do this work? What is my labor being used for? And am I okay? Do I consent with that? And that is the whole question, like, to what the ethics of, you know, highly secret innovations, to what extent, where do we draw the line with keeping the ultimate objective of an innovation a secret for people to contribute? And where is the ethics of knowing what happens with what you do? Like, you know, in Europe, we now have GDPR that we consent with sharing our data, but shouldn't we have something about, you know, consent with how our labor is being used or the outcomes of our labor?
So listening to this, and I'm glad, like Raheem, that we didn't start with Oppenheimer, right? Because I think their purpose is to tell an organizational story, and basing everything on individuals is very seductive as a narrative, but we know there is only one possible narrative and usually a very romanticized one, right? But thinking of, you know, what that happened to him and to the community of scientists, you know, and how they took positions after in light of what Greta is saying, I think in a way we went from the tragedy as an event, be it the actual, you know, bombing of cities or the fact that, you know, Cold War just escalated the race towards nuclear weapons. We moved from that to a condition, right? And the problems of secrecy, surveillance, consent, or ethics, as you're saying, Greta, just have, you know, escalated to some extent, become so complex it's even hard to tease out where they begin and where they end, right? It has kind of seeped into the infrastructure of modern life. And I'm thinking this in particular because to some extent, I wonder, you know, thinking of how it was in the Manhattan Project and the information, I was not aware, Raheem, that there was this group of dissent scientists, which I think brings exactly the question of democracy and dissent and heterogeneity and different voices and awareness and participation, right? Because we kind of so far took granted that such projects need to be secret and so on and are complex and what do you do, but well, what is being lost and what are the broader social consequences of all of that? To what extent excluding dissent in and out of them has implications? To what extent having only people that are not diverse making up such teams, right? And we know the importance of diversity for many things, including innovation and critical reflexivity, right, is important. Yet it seems that it is something that is not a topic of concern still in the way new innovations are opening up and the way in which the connection between science and military and surveillance and the state is still going on.
Just to, so this covers both what Greta and Pedro, you were just saying, which is that maybe there's, and this is a bit speculative because I also don't know much too much about the dissenting scientists from the Chicago side, et cetera, and also within Los Alamos. But maybe there's a middle layer story here between the core and periphery, which, you know, a lot of papers talk about middle layers between core and periphery anyways, where you need to be close enough to really understand the impact, but far enough that you're not part of the total institution. And so you're able to have an intelligent dissenting voice rather than, let's say, dissenting just on principle about secrecy versus sharing or something like that. And more broadly, the problem with, let's talk about, I guess, this, the kind of the ethics of what to share or hide in innovation, particularly in this sort of a new to the world innovation where there's few kind of ways to benchmark it. The problem is also a problem of valuation where you don't know what is the valuable knowledge to hide. You don't know how to estimate the impact. So, you know, all the way up till the Trinity test, some of the scientists were jokingly taking bets, a very dark humor joke, but they were taking bets on whether the atmosphere would catch fire and the world would end. So there's a valuation problem for some of these new to the world innovations where it's hard to make that decision about what to protect, what is legitimate, what is an ethical or unethical choice around knowledge sharing versus concealing, because you're just not able to place value on the knowledge or on its implications.
Moreover, it's very easy to do that in retrospect. It may be worth just a moment to sort of separate the ethics and the valuation or the morality. It starts with the question is, how much responsibility is to be borne by those who were part of the project for what was basically outside of their purview, outside of their control. We aren't necessarily in the habit of pinning those same questions on the national leaders or the political leaders at the same time. Thinking forward with, we talk about innovations nowadays, the bar really gets kind of high because we're now expecting or anticipating that people who are pursuing these innovations are now able to think about the implications of their innovations in advance. You kind of see this in the rhetoric and the media around when innovations take place. And I don't know that it's entirely possible. As a matter of fact, I think it sometimes comes across to me as like a barrier to innovation. If we were going to spend all of the time trying to think about the different ways in which social media could be misused, would anybody have ever started Facebook? That sort of a thing. It's very easy for us to, you know, to look back and wonder, what was the, you know, what were we thinking by dropping those bombs without thinking about what was happening at the time, for example, in the Pacific Theater? There's a tremendous documentary similar to The Day After Trinity. This is one on Robert McNamara. It's called The Fog of War, and it talks about him and his role in the attempts in the Pacific Theater to try to use carpet bombing or massive amounts of bombing to level Japanese cities and try to break their will prior to the dropping of the atomic bomb. It is dramatic when you think about just what devastation was done prior to the atomic bomb being dropped, and yet the Japanese were not breaking their will. In fact, the Japanese were very, very intent on continuing and pressing on the fight, even if just about the entire island was leveled. They were just not going to back down until Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The tough part is that we are looking at these events from many years of context since, and the ethics and the morality associated with how we think about the use of nuclear weapons has certainly evolved from 1945. It's important to be fair to those who were in the project that, on the one hand, the conditions probably should have been where they were able to dissent and share information better or whatever. Maybe the outcomes would have been different or something which, you know, might have been more effective or whatever. It is something that I think we have to be careful about of trying to put our current context back into theirs because it's so much different. I hope that makes sense.
does. I haven't seen that movie, but I will later. But my devil's advocate position is that in that fog of war, maybe what you need is a new pair of eyes, right? Because given all that we said about the homogeneity of some organizations, the extent secrecy is used to normatively keep people too ingrained to the task, maybe what we need is not only to think about collective intelligence, like people, you know, study and talk about for doing innovation, leveraging the skills of, you know, a crowd and all different type of people to do something, but to reflect on the implications of what we are doing, right? So not just to think in terms of how can we escalate, and, you know, we talked about this in our episode about innovation, you know, draw from all sorts of sources about building something new, but to reflect on that, right? And I'm very, it's great that you talk about social media in relationship to nuclear energy and weapons, because I feel that that's a great parallel, right? That social media, like the nuclear energy, can be used to power a city, but it can also be used in a bomb, right? We did not become very good at, you know, solving this, but we got better at using such energy and wielding that to some purposes, right? We are still making bombs, and that is not anything that we have been solved, but we found a way to maybe do safer nuclear energy, right? I don't think we have got better at doing safer and better social media, but I think that's where the collective agency needs to go, not just in building new things, but in thinking how we regulate, put parameters, think about long-term implications, like we think about the waste that nuclear power plants create, how we organize and use and leverage our human capacity to think also about the implications. So not just accept that it's hard, but try to think as that as part of the innovation process. And it's something that should bring together multiple voices and ideas.
Totally agree. And, you know, here bringing in, you know, the unintended consequences. And, you know, I think this conversation is just such a good illustration of the importance of doing these historical cases and to look back with the knowledge we have now and applying it to the situation then and imagining if we were the people in the Manhattan Project to see, like, you know, when you're working on it, you're managing for the intended consequences, but sometimes you don't see the unintended consequence. And this is an incredible example. And I think what you mentioned, Rowan, about, you know, the importance of managing core versus periphery dynamics is really, really important, because the people at the core, just they work for their purpose. They have to be completely focused. You have to engage the Nobel Prize winners and all these experts, and they're really good at what they do. But then you also need people that are able to look at it from a different perspective, the diversity, to understand, okay, what are actually the ramifications? Are we on the right path? What is this path? What is it leading us towards? And is this what we want? And, you know, this is a perfect example with, you know, looking at how social media has had an impact on society, how Google search algorithms have an impact on society, for instance, thinking about, you know, people of color, how they interact with internet technologies and search technologies versus white people, thinking about how algorithms and automation technologies are being shaped. I think we can learn a lot by going back to these cases. And of course, we should be careful to apply the knowledge we have now and having an opinion. Definitely, I agree with you, Tom. But also it helps us to understand, like, what could they have done different? I mean, it would almost be a Harvard Business case study for a different outcome to be there. For instance, one question I have is, like, you know, if they were so good at keeping everything a secret, how come the knowledge about building an atomic bomb spread all across the world? You tell me.
I think that's one of the points I had wanted to raise in part one, or ask about in part one, because I did find it, I think it was the Feynman documentary, how everybody figured out something's going on in New Mexico. You know, when you have all these shipments coming in to a place that ordinarily doesn't have a whole lot of shipments, operational security is the operative word in the United States. It's a whole bunch of seemingly open transactions can lead to people putting two and two together and deducing that something big is happening. And then
It's just a matter of process of elimination. What is that big thing? That sort of recognition has become a part of when we talk about security training or whatever, we're not just talking about, you know, how do we protect those things that have been identified as classified, but how do we prevent the accumulation or the ability of others to accumulate knowledge, which otherwise would create the equivalent of an important secret? That's a fundamental part of our security training.
Yeah, I guess I wanted to address both Tom's point first and then maybe the point Greta was making before that. So having a noisy information environment plays a big role where you're able to rest at alternative explanations. So if you think of a modern day example, you know, Apple could be working on some new secret project, but it could be a new iPhone, it could be a new iPad, it could be a new watch, it could be a new TV, or it could be some new to the world thing that we don't know at all. And in that kind of a setting, just knowing that something is going on doesn't necessarily give away what's going on because there's a lot going on. On top of that, of course, we see it in the Manhattan Project and we see it in modern day examples. There's also an intentional seeding of a noisy information environment, you know, like disinformation type campaigns where there are some anecdotes, at least, of them sending people to Santa Fe, the nearest big city, and just talking in bars loudly about the wrong things. And so, because, for example, in Los Alamos, the other rumors were that they're working on submarines, they're working on electric rockets. And you see these rumors pop up in the Santa Fe, New Mexican, so in their local newspaper as well, where the journalists are debating, is this a camp for pregnant women of the Women's Army Corps, because there were so many babies born at Los Alamos, etc. So I think that mix of rumors and spreading disinformation also makes it such that you can know something is going on without necessarily figuring out what's going on. And then to Greta's point, I think you're totally right in the sense that a big benefit of historical analysis and scholarship is to do things differently, or at least figure out how things might have happened differently. I would add to that that it also seems to suggest that the solutions needed often are structural, because when you read into these historical cases, you realize at the individual level how much of it is accidents and path dependence, that you realize that the way forward is probably structural. What I mean by accidents, for example, or let me put it this way. Even in the Manhattan Project, you see all of the potential solutions already there in the mix, and only one of them gets picked. And there often you see that kind of accident and path dependence. One of the solutions suggested at Los Alamos and elsewhere was that they would just demo, like they would tell Japan and they would drop the bomb in an uninhabited part of Japan to show them what it can do. And hopefully that should be enough to scare them off, et cetera. So all solutions are out there. And it's very hard to, when I read that, I for me, that was a no-brainer, but it's impossible for me, like Tom was saying, to actually put myself in that context and see it as anything other than a no-brainer that, yeah, come on, you can just demo it. You've used, your bureaucratic apparatus has reached its conclusion, but it doesn't have to take lives. And yeah, and we can keep talking about accidents. Another quick one that I came across and that was also kind of blew my mind was they had a list of targets and they had told the Air Force ahead of time to not bomb those targets. And like Tom was saying, you know, carpet bombing was doing probably cumulatively way more damage. And we tend to forget that in light of the atomic bombings. But they had a list of targets and one of them was Kyoto, and Secretary of War Henry Stimson, who was not kind of in favor of, you know, he was looking for a less destructive solution anyways. He took Kyoto off the list. And one of the reasons is that he and his wife had visited Kyoto and they had seen how like culturally vibrant it is, etc. I'm not saying, you know, it's very hard to argue counterfactual. So I'm not saying Kyoto would have stayed on the list, but it is kind of mind-blowing to uncover these little historical accidents that have huge life-altering implications.
Thanks for that. And we've really covered quite a lot of ground. I mean, it's a fascinating case. And I mean, we started with looking at it from an organizational secrecy lens, perhaps, but there's so many other directions that you can go with this, because not just because of how fascinating the story itself is, but just how much it has shape to the future. Just kind of like to open the floor. Any final thoughts or comments or takeaways?
I'm still reverberating in my mind the importance of such reflexivity we gain from looking back, right? And I think that maybe it's exactly because throughout the episode, I think we have been trying to grasp with the fact that in many ways, the legacy of the Manhattan Project has not necessarily been so positive, right? And we still have not been able to find ways to apply reflexivity to the world that it created, that brought, you know, new weapons, but also brought this collaboration, military science in an unchecked manner, right? Because things, maybe they're not declared a secret, but they're removed from the public debate. So I think that's one way to untangle and to show that this itself was fortuitous, right? That this itself was a choice made at some point that we start to take for granted and is the way through which things operate, is to go back in time and to see when it emerged and how it was not, or it was, but it didn't pick up enough critical voices and the capacity to reflect and what it led to, right? So I'm just thinking that looking back to the history of how it emerged can be the first step to allow us to envision a future in which things can be different.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think what we've seen in this discussion is that For example, from an organizational standpoint, the Manhattan Project or such modes of organizing are inherently dual, where on the one hand, you've got speed, scale, secrecy. We didn't cover this, but for example, they had to quickly change the planning. In the beginning, they estimated they would need around 100 scientists. In the end, it was, you know, tens of thousands of people across. But what secrecy and allows you is that speed, where for another example, you could say, you could tell the governor of Tennessee that we need all the concrete manufactured in the state needs to be redeployed to place X. Why? For whom? Who's we? What are you going to do with it? Doesn't matter. It's you know, priority A. So it has those coordination benefits, but then it comes at the cost of asking those questions of critical kind of thinking about the purpose itself. So I think what we've learned is that this mode of organizing is both positive and negative, and there's a lot going on. But also what we've learned is the importance of, to pick up your word again, of reflexivity, where if we are to just live in the legacy of the Manhattan Project, then we would be the voices who are saying we need a Manhattan Project for climate change. But it's reflexivity that allows you to say, do we need a Manhattan Project for anything? And I'm not saying the answer is no, but the point is that it makes you look at it from a different lens to the legacy that we have received about the project.
We thank Rohan Bhopajari for graciously joining us in this episode. And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.